welcome to Docupied, a podcast about anime, manga, light novels, and industry news. I'm your host, Brandon, otherwise known as DocPay, and let's jump right into the discussion series for this week. I still don't really know what to call this, but I guess it's a recommendation. So as you know by the title, this week I'll be discussing The Genius Prince's Guide to Raising a Nation Out of Debt. Hey, how about treason? By Toru Toba. The series is published by Yen On, which is an imprint of Yen Press, and there are currently four volumes out. The fourth volume just dropped on Tuesday, and the fifth volume is due out in December, I think. So as usual, here's your light spoiler warning. I won't be giving any specifics with regards to plot or character developments or anything major, but I will be talking in general about this series and all the above. So regard this like you would first impressions or a review. This series is another one in the similar vein, we'll say, as some of the others that I've already talked about. And I've mentioned that there's a whole slew of them that I've actually been enjoying, but are relatively similar in a lot of ways. I've already talked about Realist Hero or Altina. I've talked about The Economics of Prophecy. And I haven't talked about this one, but Isekai Rebuilding Project is another one. And so The Genius Prince is yet another to add to that list of similar series. None of them are identical, and none of them are so overlapping that reading them all feels like I've already read it. However, they all have, a number of similarities. At the very least, on a surface level. And so that actually makes it pretty easy to recommend, saying that if you've enjoyed any of the others that I mentioned relate similar to this, then you will also like this series. So like I said, it's got a lot of similarities to those other works, namely that they're series set in somewhat fantasy-ish medieval kingdoms, where the main characters are either in control of some country or dealing with high-level political conflict, war, and in general just about either ruling, a medieval kingdom. In many of those works that are isekai, they're about using their otherworld knowledge to help restructure or rebuild them. So The Genius Prince is not an isekai. And I think that's one thing that delineates a number of these series, is whether it's an isekai or not. A handful of them, like Realist Hero and Economics of Prophecy, Isekai Rebuilding Project, those are all isekai. The main characters come from our world. And then you have Altina and Genius Prince. And these two series are pure fantasy, with no isekai elements at all. And I hate to kind of frame the entire discussion of Genius Prince as all in relation to the other series I've talked about, but it kind of makes sense to start there, and then I'll dig into where it's different and what sets it apart. Its setting is also kind of a medieval kingdom type setting. So similar to Altina, there is also no direct magic or any other real fantasy elements to it, at least as far as been introduced in the first three volumes. Volume 4 just came out and I actually started it, but I haven't finished it, so I don't want to include too much about that. But suffice it to say, in the first, three volumes, the only thing is, there's one other race of people that one of the main characters is, and it's really not clear if they're supernatural. I mean, I don't think they are. There's nothing in particular that seems to indicate that. And there aren't any, as far as has been introduced, fantasy races. So no, beast people or elves or dwarves or none of that. So far, all they've introduced and talked about are humans. And then this, race of people that are, white-haired, red-eyed. But that's really it. They don't have, there's no magic, there's no abilities, there's nothing like that. So that's about the most fantasy that this series really gets, is that there's a race of people that have white hair and red eyes. So let's talk about the characters then. Our main character is Wine. He is the prince of a kingdom called Natra. Within the story, his father is still alive, who is the current king. He's simply sick, so he's kind of off in the background. Doesn't really play a role, at least so far, and I assume that's very intentional. And then we have his aide, I guess is the way to call her, Ninim. She is a member of that, like, white-haired, red-eyes race called Flam. Within the context of this world, a lot of the nations to their west, for example, the Flam are like an incredibly marginalized and like persecuted peoples. However, the nation of, or the kingdom of Natra, is not that way. So they are not at all persecuted there. And in fact, members of the Flam have always held these like positions of aides to the royal family. And so Ninim is Wine's aide. Now, the relationship between the two of them definitely serves as like a strong core of the series. And I've said this about a couple other works, and I do think a good dynamic between main cast can really carry a series. But Wine and Ninim, in their case, there's really something compelling about their dynamic. And it's not in the way that, you know, it's just a straight romance or they're in love or that, you know, they make a good comedy duo. And they certainly kind of do all of that in a lot of different ways. But very early on, Wine is quite clear that to him, Ninim is basically his heart. And that's not like the type of sentiment that you see in many other kind of young adult novels in that way, where, you know, they're not married and they're not engaged to be married in that way. That's not how the aid system works and all that. But there's such a clear and like direct bond that these two share that all the other characters both recognize it, acknowledge it, and in many ways know that it's essentially like immovable. Their bond is such that nothing will like shake that. And at least considering what I've read so far, I'd be hard pressed to come up with a situation that even the writer could say that puts them on the outs. Like that would have to be a real significant plot development kind of thing, which could make for an interesting story. But the point being, there's more here than just a romance plot. There's more than just, you know, close aides. They're more than simply a prince and his aide. And throughout the first three volumes, Wine goes, I would say, significantly out of his way to both protect, but also ensure that Ninim is treated fairly. So because she comes from this persecuted peoples, whenever they're dealing with countries where those her people are still persecuted, there's a lot of considerations that have to go into it, and essentially he suffers no amount of prejudice against her. He will tolerate none of it. And there's definitely something heartwarming there to see like the degree to which he rejects all of that. Ninim, for her part, is also, she's more than just like the love interest or, you know, the aide or anything like that. And the fact that, you know, he considers her his heart should tell you that she is both, you know, sounding board, motivation, and she has to keep him on track. She's there to remind Wine of, like, his responsibilities and duties, and he's there to like, rein in his wild ideas. She's there to support him. She's there to provide, I mean, anything she can. And it's not just that, though, is that she genuinely believes in Wine himself, that he'll end up doing the right thing, that despite all of his grumbling, he really is like a prince worth dedicating her time and effort toward. And the two of them have like a very clear back and forth. This isn't a one-way relationship in any facet. It definitely feels like a strong two-way street that they are using and constantly playing off of. There's just a very strong dynamic here. So I guess I should have backed up and explained what the essential premise of the story is. So in this, you know, medieval fantasy kingdom-ish world, Natra is a small, not particularly powerful kingdom centered between like east and west on this continent, where to the east there's this big sprawling empire that controls essentially everything, and to the west are a bunch of other nations, powerful nations in their own rights, and they're kind of in the middle. And so to Wine, his kind of main gripe is that he doesn't necessarily want to inherit Natra as the crown prince, and given the opportunity, he'd love to just like sell off the nation to the empire and be absorbed into them and not have to deal with any of the responsibility of being, you know, the crown prince and the next king and all that. And so inside, like in private with Ninim, he's always complaining about, you know, things giving him more work or causing him to have to veer from his plan of selling off the kingdom. And he really does talk a big game in that regard, but in kind of every instance, given the actual opportunity and chance to do so, his actions seem to always kind of go in the opposite direction. He does actually, you know, treasure this nation and his relationship with his family and retainers and the kingdom itself, whether or not he wants to say that, and he definitely won't. So there's definitely kind of more to him than simply, you know, a guy who wants to live the easy life. Because, you know, he definitely does, or he thinks he does, but everything he actually ends up doing and the decisions he ends up making, like, clearly don't support that necessarily. Like, he still knows what he has to do and, like, what he should be doing. And so the things he ends up doing don't really lead to, like, the things he says he wants. So kind of another interesting aspect of this book is that the series definitely has, or Wine in particular, has kind of an irresponsible Captain Tyler-esque nature to it. Less in the fact that in Tyler, you were never supposed to be clear on whether or not he was actually competent and knew what he was doing. Like, at all times, it was meant to be a toss-up whether what he did was insightful and intentional, or pure luck, or like intuitive or intuition based. You're really never supposed to be able to know or judge, and that's kind of the gag of Tyler, is that he ends up doing the right thing at the right time, whether he meant to or not. However, in Wine's case, it's more like he goes into it with a certain plan in mind, or like a certain facade, and other characters read him completely differently. And so to them, that he, like to the other characters and his retainers and his family and people not Ninim, essentially, are all reading into what he does and says in this like incredibly positive and like optimistic light. And like they all think that he's some like super high level, and he is clearly like the genius prince, but they read his act, they like read into his actions being like way more like righteous, maybe is the right word, or patriotic or positive in their mind, essentially. They just constantly read him as like this real heroic type figure. And we get to hear his kind of internal monologue where he's going into it thinking and like trying to set something up, and they all are like, oh my god, he's so amazing. Like, who knew he was, that's what his goal was in doing this. And like, it ends up working out for him in the way that it does for Tyler. But in fact, it ends, like, oftentimes it ends up working out against what he says he wants, and actually works out in the way that everyone around him thinks that he wanted it to work out. And by that, I mean, like, you know, good for the country. He is the genius prince that's going to lead them to like a new golden age kind of thing. And so everything he ends up doing ends up just raising his stocks with the people and the people around him. And so that's what I mean, where it's like, it's got that Tyler-esque, everything kind of goes right for him, even if it's technically going wrong for what he claims he wants, which is to, like, live the easy life and sell off the country. So there's quite a good bit of comedy that revolves around this, like, mismatch in expectations and reality in what he does and says and how everyone else takes what he does and says. And I quite enjoy that. Irresponsible Captain Tyler is, like, one of my favorite series, and I love the concept there. And so applying it to this is actually quite amusing. And then you have Ninim, who, like, knows his inner thoughts. And by that I mean, like, he communicates with her. Like, there's no secrets between the two of them in that way. And so, you know, she gets just as exasperated. Like, she can read him, what he's thinking or monologuing on the inside while doing these things, and just, like, facepalming when everyone else reads, like, way too far into it. Or, you know, when he's facepalming internally, you know, she gives him that, like, nudge in the back and, like, hey, do this right, do this properly. Or, like, now that this has turned out this way, you know you've got to follow it through, kind of thing. So different from Tyler, he's definitely the genius prince. Like, there's no question within the context of the story that he is good at strategy and tactics, and definitely, like, a high-level schemer. And so in that regard, it's more of the difference in, like, expectation that is kind of like Tyler, which is amusing. There's a number of other characters that get introduced over the course of volumes 2 and 3, or 1, 2, and 3, I guess, but more specifically 2 and 3. They introduce additional, like, neighboring kingdoms. They bring in a character from the Empire, a princess there, Lolmina, in volume 2, and she's kind of heavily involved in the plot there. Volume 3 brings in a conflict in another country to the west, and actually kind of re-involves the plot line and the events of the first volume with their, like, immediate neighbor to the west, a kingdom called Mardin. That actually plays a significant role in volume 3, and that plot line, like, continues. And so that's something that I have been enjoying about the storyline, is that everything is definitely connected in that way. The events of volume 1 definitely tie into and lead into things that happen in volume 2, which then, like, precipitate things that happen in volume 3, or more specifically, what he did in volume 1 ends up almost directly causing the things he has to deal with in volume 3. The plotline in volume 2 actually seems to trigger things that are, and volume 3 all kind of trigger the events that kick off volume 4, which, you know, I haven't gotten through entirely, so I can't speak to too much of it, but it's clear that there's, like, direct connection between them all, and there's definitely a good degree of thought that is put into the way that the story continues to evolve, and the way that the world around Wine and Ninim, like, reacts to what they're doing in the story, and puts them in additional amusing situations for us to enjoy, I guess we'll say. or give Wine new opportunities to continue to fall upward. I haven't mentioned her, but Wine has a sister. I haven't mentioned her, but Wine has a younger sister named Felania, and she's somewhat in the background of the first three volumes, and I'm actually quite interested in that she seems to be a larger focus in volume 4 and is getting her own kind of plot and character development there. She definitely gets a bit of development throughout the volumes, like various kind of moments that they introduce and bring up, and she gets to grow a little, but she hasn't been, like, a major focus of any of the plot stuff. And so I'm actually really excited to get back and finish volume 4, because she's clearly playing a central role in what's going on there. And as much as, you know, I said that Wine and Ninim are, like, a strong center to this series, it's nice that the author is taking time to, you know, develop additional side characters that can hold their own as characters, so that she's more than just, you know, the younger sister that he dotes on and that looks up to him. Throughout the kind of first three volumes, she's wanted to be, like, of more help to her brother, take some of his burden. She want her not take, but like share in his responsibilities. She just wants to help him out more. She wants to be useful. She wants to be more than just doted on. She wants to be relied on. And so that's going to like propel her to grow as a person and obviously a character. And so that's where volume 4 kicks off. And so I'm quite excited to like see where that goes. And also see what kind of nonsense that means Wine has and Ninim have to get up to, or get out of, rather. The writing is fairly straightforward. It's not as dense as something like I talked about last week, which is The Alchemist Who Survived. Like, that's a very dense light novel. This series comes in at like under 200 pages of volume and lots of dialogue, not particularly like complicated like writing or plotting. It's a fairly like straightforward light novel. I'd say the writing is decent. The prose has a decent cadence to it. You can get through it pretty quick. But it also definitely doesn't come off as like this author's, you know, very first time trying to write anything. Like, it is not bad, and it doesn't have that like amateur writer feel to it that often a lot of light novel series do. I'd never claim it's anything special or anything like that, but clearly the author knows what they're doing. Like, the character dynamics, the way that the plot connects and flows forward, the comedy is well done. Like, it is a solidly written light novel series. Volume 2 actually gives me a pretty good example of what I'm talking about here. So the series is largely written or narrated by Wine or Ninim, and there's also a lot of third person. There are like a number of either chapters or like bits of chapters that are from other character perspectives, and they sprinkle those in plenty, but we largely follow Wine and Ninim. And what that means is in volume 2, there's quite an interesting, I guess, narration device, we'll say. I'm not really sure how to describe it, but since we follow our main duo, Lowell Mina, who is kind of the focus of volume 2, is clearly out and scheming to do something, and trying to wrap up Wine and Ninim into this, like, you know, bit of intrigue. And so she's doing things and plotting things like outside of the scope of the narration. We as readers don't get to see it because Wine and Ninim as narrators and point of views don't know it either. And so we go through this volume learning about what's going on with them. As they figure things out with Lomina and the situation, we figure things out. And I actually think it does that quite successfully, you know, because the entire volume is about all of them trying to like outmaneuver each other, to scheme, and it's all about the intrigue of what they're doing. And so because Lomina's scheme is what Wine is trying to uncover, or Wine and Ninim are trying to both uncover and either, you know, twist to their advantage or put a stop to it, or, you know, just counter straight up, I really liked that the author used like the main character's narration, or the fact that they are the POVs, to like withhold a bunch of information about Lolmina. So she shows up and they have conversations, but she's hiding things, and we as readers don't get to know them. Like, the narrator doesn't just like switch to her point of view and spill her plan to us just because like we want them to. And so we get to feel that same intrigue and frustration that the main characters do, that builds as the volume builds. And so it makes for a nice bit of writing. And so I think that's a really good example of how the author understands how to use narration and perspective, and write these characters in an interesting way. So it definitely comes off as more polished than a number of other light novels would. So kind of all in all, I'd say the series is interesting. It's not necessarily the most like unique or innovative or new series out there, but it has a lot going for it. I quite enjoy it, and a lot of the overlapping elements that it has that are similar to some of those other series I've talked about mean that like at its core, at its base, I already was interested in it. And the fact that it's well executed and written and has decent characters and plotting make it all the more appealing to me. Like, it's not necessarily your, you know, standard light novel either. So there's a lot more here to like about it than there is to complain, like, about its similarities. And so while I'm playing up the fact that it is similar to a number of other series, that's only in the respect of, if you like those, you'll like this. So, like, don't look any deeper into that. Just come out knowing that I think there's more here than meets the eye. And because the volumes are rather short and succinct, kind of a lot happens. Like, the plot moves quite quickly. A lot happens each volume in like, under 200 pages. So it's not a series that's going to stagnate and just flounder and flail about and doing nothing. In the first three volumes, a lot happens in terms of, like, plotting. Plus, at least so far, the world that Torotoba has established and created is interesting. There's a lot of setup here, and there's plenty of stuff to mine in the setup and the world. And even just, you know, the simple things, like the fact that each volume is building on the other to the world is reacting to the things the characters are doing. Like, all that's just really positive for me. And knowing that as I continue to read, that the things that the characters are doing continue to have consequences and effect on the actual world itself, that then come back and cause more plot and more things to happen, just means that there's ever more reason to just keep reading this series. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm going to go finish volume 4 now, and I hope that you pick this series up and enjoy it as much as I have. That's going to be it for this episode. This episode's recommendation was The Genius Prince's Guide to Raising a Nation Out of Debt. Hey, how about treason? By Torotoba, published by Yen On, which is an imprint from Yen Press. There are currently 4 volumes released. The 5th is due out in December, so thanks for listening. Follow my Twitter, I am DocPay, for updates. If you liked Occupied, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Every little bit helps and helps others find and start listening to it. I'll catch you next time.